Over the long centuries, those who came to the Holy Land were the elderly and the pious. The pious came to pray at the Wailing Wall and to, by their prayers, hasten the coming of the Messiah. The elderly came to die in the land from which resurrection would spring, the Holy Land. About 100 years ago, a new type of immigrant began to appear at the dock Jaffa. He was young, a teenager, and anything but pious. He was in rebellion against the life of his home in Europe, all of its limitations, economic, political, cultural, religious. He was out to establish a new life in a free world, a world which would be of his own making. It was the very emptiness and barrenness of the Holy Land which appeared to him because it gave him an opportunity to build again, to live without all of the constrictions and restrictions of life as a Jew in Europe. These young people came without money, but with great hope. And they found that the only way of earning a living was to apply as a migrant worker in the workers' exchange near Petah Tikva, Rishon LeZion, the first colonies, to be a migrant worker, harvest time or seed time under the hot sun for a day's wages. The young came, and many of them were able to stay. Now, those who manned the docks in Jaffa, the Turkish officials, could look at a man or a woman and tell where they were bound. The elderly for Jerusalem, for the Wailing Wall, the young for the workers' exchange. But one day in 1904, a rather elderly-looking man appeared. He wasn't quite as old as he looked. He was 48, white-haired, tall, emaciated, rather sickly. His skin was white, his hands were smooth. He was obviously not a laborer. He was a man who in Europe had worked with his mind. But he asked the way to the labor exchange. And the young people with whom he stood in line the next days looked at him and smiled to themselves, and they said, he'll never be able to make it. Within a week, two, he'll be on his way back to Europe. They looked and they smiled because they had very little experience with a man who was possessed of a grand vision. This man's name was Aaron David Gordon. He had worked on a baronial estate in Russia as a steward. He had been part of a group of literary Jews in Odessa. And gradually he had become convinced that there was only one great regenerative principle for civilization and for mankind and for the individual man. And that was for man to leave behind him all of the complexities of modern urban life, all of the artificiality of what we call civilization, and to become one with himself by becoming one with nature, to become one with himself through hard work under the hot sun in God's creation. Gordon was not unlike any number of thinkers in Europe and America in the 19th century, who were convinced that there was something disastrous in the way in which civilization was developing. They looked at the city, and what did they see? They saw mass poverty. They saw the brutalization of factory life. They saw dirt and tenement buildings. But most of all, they saw unhappy, beaten, depressed people given to occasional moments of violence and of cruelty. People who had been broken, who were no longer whole, no longer of a piece. And these thinkers, great novelist Leo Tolstoy in Russia, the essayist and philosopher Henry Thoreau in the United States, men like A.D. Gordon in Palestine, became convinced that the only way to heal man was to return to the basics, to nature, to the open air, to hard work, to the soil, and to God. And they returned to the soil, each in his own way. Tolstoy went back to the great feudal estate which belonged to his family at Vasnaya. He would occasionally don a peasant's garment and work for a day or so in the field, and then return to his study and to his books. And Thoreau went out, as you know, to Walden Pond, and he built himself there a cabin. And he lived there for 2 years and wrote some magnificent essays, but he made sure that Walden Pond was only a half day's walk from Concord and that the Literary Society of Concord could visit him from time to time for tea. Only Gordon, really, lived the life of the peasant, the man who involved himself wholly in physical labor. Now, we are the heirs not of Gordon, but of Tolstoy and of Thoreau. For what is an American suburb but that kind of compromise which they attempted to establish? I can't wait, a man told me recently, until I leave the office and I go home and I get in some old clothes and I get out into the garden and I get my hands in the soil. Well, that's fine. It's a wonderful feeling. But what he's also saying is I need the office. I need the economic opportunities of the city. I need the cultural life of the community. We've established a kind of compromise between those who fight for simplicity and nature and those who argue for the city and what we call civilization, the culture of the civitas of the city. But Gordon was of another type, a stronger type, perhaps. Gordon lived his philosophy. He labored for 5 long years as a day worker, as a migrant worker, as a wetback, if you will, in the small colonies of Palestine. And then he became one of the founding fathers of Degania, which is today a rather wealthy colony near the Galilee, but in those days was a very primitive little farming community in a swampland which needed to be drained. He worked, and he talked, and he wrote. And he became something of a father figure to the teenagers who had come out with him. He was older, he expressed himself more ably, and he provided them a rationale for so much of what they were living. Here were young people who every week or so were receiving letters from their parents back home in Poland and Russia, wondering if they weren't really becoming peasants, muzhiks. In Europe, in Eastern Europe, the peasant was looked down on. He was illiterate, a boor. Yet Gordon was telling them that this life in the soil was healing, and saving, and redemptive. And here were these young people who had left poverty and left oppression and the pogroms, but who had also left civilization, the theater and music and art, who had none of this in their colonies. And we were being told by Gordon that these are really essentially trivial, peripheral. That the basic thing, the thing which will make you whole, which will give your life meaning, is the work that you do, the changes which will take place in you, and the new relationships, the new essential relationships which you will adopt towards those who are working the soil along with you. Now, Gordon had arguments with these young pioneers. They came out fired with a kind of basic Marxism, socialism. They were convinced that when one had to remove the class structure from the social order, one would inevitably create a new breed of man, that it is the institutions of the economy of production and of distribution which create the perversions which are so evident in modern man, the split personality which so many of us have seen and noted. And he argued with them that simply removing the economic oppression, the class structure, would not in and of itself change human nature. That man must change himself, and that change must begin by exchanging the complexities of the city for the simplicities of the farm, and the kibbutz, and of basic life. His writings had a certain charm. His personality had great appeal. And whenever I teach a course in modern Jewish thought, I always give the young people in my classes a chance to be exposed to Gordon, because he tells us something about the idealism which fired the Zionist movement in its earliest years, and he tells us a great deal that our society is still eager to hear. For so many of the youngsters who are in the classes are also people who are tempted by the farms of Vermont, by basic foods, by the natural life. They talk constantly of putting it all together, of becoming whole. And the religion of labor, which is what Gordon tended to call his faith, is a very attractive one to them. This year, as we read Gordon, one of the youngsters unexpectedly said to me, "It doesn't sound Jewish. Isn't Gordon a unique? I've thought all my life that Jews valued the mind rather than the muscle. I've always assumed that we respected the scholar rather than the farmer, peasant. And I've also, whenever I've been in class here at the university and that we've talked about work, they've talked to me about the Protestant work ethic. I didn't know that Judaism had a work ethic. Well, let's see. Let's see what the record says." And as I listened to their question, and as I heard myself answer them with the record, which I'll come to in a minute, I reminded myself of those innumerable conversations I've had with some of you. When I tried to say to you as parents, your youngster would really like to be a farmer, or an auto mechanic, or a forester, or a carpenter, you've looked at me with fire in your eyes. My son, a blue-collar worker, my son with dirt under his fingernails, my son's got to go to college. Every good Jewish boy and girl has to go to college. You think that was the 11th commandment given by God to Moses on Mount Sinai? Somehow, this generation of Jews, at least, assumes that the only way to fulfillment and to happiness is through a college diploma and some white-collar, preferably professional, occupation. But what's the record and how did it all come about? If we look at the Bible, I would ask you to notice that no one in the Bible ever received a college degree. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were the heads of clans who occupied themselves as herdsmen and as blacksmiths, itinerant clans who often hired themselves out during seed time and harvest to the local Canaanite city as migrant workers. The Bible tells us that Moses worked for 40 years as a shepherd. Very few of the occupations of the prophets are given to us, but Amos was a shepherd and a tender of sycamore trees. And the legend of Elisha tells us that he was plowing behind oxen in his field when Elijah suddenly appeared and summoned him to his mission. When the Bible describes happiness, and it does so rarely, it tends to describe happiness in terms of work. Ashrecha v'tovlach, yegia kapecha ki tochal. When you will eat the produce of your own hands, then it will be happy for you and good for you. Now, work is looked upon in the Bible as necessary. The sluggard who does not plant in the springtime or plow in the springtime will beg in the harvest and stomach will be empty. But more than simply a necessity, work is looked upon as a kind of fulfillment. Sweet is the sleep of the laborer, whether he eats little or much. There's a fulfillment in the work that we do. And that theme is sounded again and again in our scripture. Now, one of the interesting differences between the biblical culture and the culture of the kingdoms and empires and communities which surrounded it is that no one was ever denied high office because of the humbleness of his origins or because of the work at which he had been set. Saul was searching for a donkey which he had lost. He was a young man who was employed as a muleteer when Samuel chanced upon him and chose him to be king of Israel. And David, as you will remember, was tending the sheep of his father when he was chosen for that high dignity. By comparison, I give you Aristotle, who says in many ways, again and again, that a man who is an artisan or a craftsman or a laborer cannot know virtue and cannot aspire to be a citizen. In the ancient world, work belonged to the slave. power belonged to the leisured. And the mark of the powerful, the mark of privilege, the mark of fulfillment, and of the literature of the powerful and the privileged was a disdain for physical labor and for the workmen. And that disdain, interestingly, went over into the imperial church. Jesus, of course, was a carpenter's son. He had no illusions about the grandeur of leisure. But when the church became the imperial church of the Roman Empire, it took over all of the assumptions and the prejudices of the ancient world. And now the ecclesiastic was not to work. He was to be supported by his community. He was to have the leisure for prayer and for piety and for study and for those things which ecclesiastics are presumed to do. We call the work ethic Protestant, because it wasn't until the development of Protestantism in the 16th and 17th century in Northern Europe, a development which took place at the same time, as you know, as development of trade and commerce, craft, nascent industry in that part of the world, that the Christian world was willing to accept the tradesman and the craftsman as an equal of the literary person or of the religious person or of the nobleman before God. Now, the Protestant work ethic had within it something that the Jewish work ethic never did. It prized the virtue of industry, honorable work. It spoke of the dignity of labor. But it also tended to say that a man will get his just deserts, that if a laborer produces an honest day's labor, he will be amply rewarded for that labor, and therefore poverty is to a certain degree one's own fault, something which the prophetic social ethic of Judaism never accepted. Judaism saw the malfunctioning of the economic order at all times, the cruelty, the venality, the greed of the powerful and the privilege of the employer class. The robber baron never surprised the Jew. Justice is the great call. But be that as it may, compare the aspirations towards leisure among the Catholic priesthood and ecclesiastic to the rabbi. The rabbis of Talmudic times were students, scholars, and laborers. The greatest of them, Hillel, Akiba, Ishmael, Meir, they were cobblers and tailors and bakers. One was a coal digger. Many of them were farmers. Some of them had a little wealth. Some of them scraped by on daily wages. Among the rabbis, it was a basic statement of philosophy that what the Torah was not a spade to dig with. That one was not to use one scholarship to say to simple folk, I know and you need to support me because I know. Or I control the religious apparatus and because I do, you need to support me so that I can be your intermediary to God. I am too good, too pure, too holy to work. Quite to the contrary. Talmud tells us that God will not bestow blessings upon a man unless he works with his two hands. And they constantly emphasize the theme that no work is really degrading. Work, maybe we need to have to do things which we don't want to do, but no work is ultimately degrading. Rather, flay a carcass in the street and earn a wage than say, I am noble born, this job is a disgrace to me, I cannot do it. That's in our Talmud. There was a clear respect for the dignity of physical labor. Whence then the snobbishness about labor of our generation? Where does it come from? Obviously, it comes from something within rabbinic Judaism. The rabbi means teacher. Rabbinic Judaism values scholarship. The scholar class always has pretensions, desires, and concerns. If I spend my time, one rabbi says, sowing in the springtime and tending my field in the summer and harvesting in the fall and selling my produce in the winter, when will I have time for study? There is that concern. And there were always those who were eager to take whatever advantage they could of the learning that was theirs. But our modern snobbishness about the academic degree, about white-collar work, does not derive really from essential rabbinic Judaism. It derives, I believe, rather more from the unique economic and political situation of the Jew, particularly in Eastern Europe, particularly in the last several centuries. Apartheid was the political rule of the day. Poverty was part of the economic order. And as the world about him began to emerge from feudalism and from medievalism, the Jew, too, began to try and take advantage of the new economic opportunities. And he discovered certain things, practically and pragmatically. The one group of people who could emerge from this massive poverty were those whose minds were trained, whom the non-Jewish majority, whose services the non-Jewish majority required. The doctor, the lawyer, the dentist, the technician, the banker. The man, in all these cases, essentially, we are dealing with people who worked with their minds. He discovered that otherwise, the minute he earned enough money in the marketplace to buy himself a little store, the non-Jew who managed the village found some licensing procedure to expropriate the store and give it to a non-Jew. The minute he earned enough money from his tailoring to buy a sewing machine to begin, quote, a factory, he found that there was some law which he had violated, and the government would come in and expropriate the factory and give it to the son of one of the bureaucrats. The minute he tended a field and the field became productive and he earned more from the field than simply the support of his family, he found that some peasant claimed the field as his own and the field was taken from him. Blue-collar work, artisanship, physical labor, farming, were obviously associated in these last generations with poverty and frustration and insecurity. And it's those experiences which our parents and grandparents and great-grandparents brought with them from the old world to these shores. Yes, there was the reverence for the scholar, but when they slaved in the sweatshops of New York in order to send Junior to college, they weren't eager that he be educated, that is, cultivated. They were eager that he learn a skill with which he could finance their old age and his family. Universities were the road to taking advantage of the economic opportunity, which is America, the Golden Medina. And obviously, from their point of view, blue-collar work, factory work, was a way which you never quite managed to come out of poverty and to come out of the miserable existence which had been their lot throughout their lives. And it was they who gave to this generation all of its current attitudes about white-collar work, status occupations, and the like. Now, obviously, there's something more fulfilling in many of the professional occupations and the so-called status occupations than there is in much that goes by the name of labor. But the strange reversal has taken place in our own generation. The janitor, now called a building superintendent, who manages the school, often makes twice as much as a superintendent. And I remind you that it is the professional class in America which works 80, 90, and 100 hours a week, and the blue-collar worker who works 40 or 35 hours a week. The problem of leisure is a problem of the laborer, not of the professional. And we've come to a time in America where, from a purely economic point of view, many of us ought seriously to reassess the assumption that our children will fulfill themselves only by going to college. In part, some of them will impoverish themselves. Because it is the school teacher, the social worker, and the librarian who are at the very bottom of the economic order today, not the union worker or the factory worker. Now, obviously, there are many occupations which are difficult and many tasks which are, if not demeaning, repetitive. Some of you may have read, as I read several years ago, it's really not a book. It's a set down of a number of tape recorded interviews which a Chicago newspaper and radio columnist, Studs Terkel, did of what she called working. in which he tried, in which he interviewed people across the country about their attitudes towards the work that they did. And the work is one long litany of complaint. Between Monday and Friday, I die. It's one phrase I remember from it. In that work, you see people who are unhappy, dispirited, despondent. They feel degraded by what they do. Now, obviously, there's a great deal of difference between working in the coal mines of West Virginia and working in the construction industry in Cleveland, or between working in a tannery and working in, or a butcher shop, and working in some more graceful surroundings. And the Talmud makes no attempt to say that you must do the work that you begin doing, or you must stay with a piece of work even if you don't enjoy doing it. There are occupations, that of the muleteer, that of the tanner, which the Talmud specifically says that if you have any opportunity to get away from them, escape from them, escape. But at the same time, as I read this long litany of, to use a very unpulpit word, kvetching, I was struck by the fact that so many of the people who were working at jobs which really held a certain amount of intrinsic interest to them. If they only wouldn't look on work as they looked on school assignments when they were children in school. It's something we must get done in order to get a grade, or in order to get through to recess or to vacation or to the next grade. If you really involve yourself in what you do, there is a great deal of opportunity to find it to be fulfilling. Let me put it another way, a Jewish way. There are 10 commandments. Traditional Judaism really read the 10 commandments as 11, because they said that commandment, remember the Sabbath day, is really two commandments. Remember the Sabbath day, observe the Sabbath, and 6 days shall you labor and do all your work. 6 days you are to labor. The word for worship is the word avodah. It means the worship in the temple. The word for work is avodah. It means physical labor, the things that we do, our vocations and professions. They're the same word. Which suggests to the rabbis the idea that work is not only necessary, proper before God, requirement to survive, but it also can be healing. It can be redemptive. It can be the way in which we fulfill ourselves and through which we come into ourselves. If we come at our work with a proper spirit, if we see what can be done, how we can maximize the opportunity that is ours, then we may be finding our work, whether it be in the field or in the factory or in the congregation, fulfillment and a sense of wholeness, all that A.D. Gordon tried to find there. The rabbi said, work is easy for those who like to work. And what I'm suggesting this morning is simply that more work can be fulfilling if we'll only bring to it the proper kind of spirit. Amen.